Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder and this is The Learning College. Today we're going to do two chapters about Jews and Bolshevism and Unions from The International Jew by Henry Ford, a book of four volumes and 80 chapters that was compiled from newspaper articles put out in 1920 and 1921 in the Dearborn Independent. And as we know, the Jews prepared a sort of government-in-waiting in New York and then foisted that upon Russia in their first successful communist revolution, which they tried to follow up on by communizing the rest of Eastern and Western Europe, as well as the U.S. And they didn't overtly succeed, at least in the U.S., but they did succeed through a mutation of communism, known as multiculturalism, diversity, and political correctness today in the U.S. But anyway, going back 95 years ago, let's do two chapters as they're related, talk about the unions and Bolshevism in the U.S. and the relation with the Jews. Or some call it Judaism, I call it communism, said the number one rabbi of the first half of the 20th century, Stephen Wise. Anyway, I believe this is chapter, let's see, 49, is that right? Yes, that's chapter 49, Jewish Hotbeds of Bolshevism in the U.S., and then we'll do chapter 50 as part of this same session, Jew Trades Link with World Revolutionaries, the trades like the needle trade, the garment district, the garment workers union. Jews were running all this, gave them time to be revolutionaries in between because it's garment work is piecework. You can pick it up and put it down and stop right in the middle of it, unlike in other industries. So there's lots of time for radicals to organize. And they have a strong power base with hundreds of thousands of Jews from Eastern Europe who've already been in the radical soup there, coming over to the U.S. and creating these warrens, shtetls, ghettos, hovels, all condensed in a very small space there in New York. Seedbed, a hotbed of radicalism that would go on to change the world in terribly destructive ways in the 20th century, and indeed their foul work continues into the 21st century. But let's start with chapter 49, Jewish Hotbeds of Bolshevism in the U.S. And again, the earlier 48 chapters that we've completed are all found at VNN Forum. So, chapter 49, Jewish Hotbeds of Bolshevism in the U.S. Jewish Hotbeds of Bolshevism in the U.S. Remember, the Nazis considered they were fighting against Judeo-Bolshevismus, Jewish-Bolshevism. So, Ford says, Bolshevism is working in the United States through precisely the same channels it used in Russia, and through the same agents, revolutionary and predatory unionism, as distinct from business and uplift unionism, that is legitimate unionism, and Jewish agitators. When Martens, M-A-R-T-E-N-S, the so-called Soviet ambassador, left the United States after being deported, he appointed as the representative of Bolshevik Sovietism in the United States one Charles Recht. Capital R-E-C-H-T, Recht means right in German. A Jew, lawyer by profession, this Charles Recht, who maintained an office in New York. This office is the rendezvous of all the Jewish union leaders in New York, some of the later labor leaders throughout the country, and occasionally one or two American government officials known to be henchmen of Jewish aspirations in the U.S. and sympathizers with predatory radicalism. So remember, the context here is the Jews communize Russia. They make a putsch, they make a successful revolution. Within 5 years of this article being written in probably 1921, and they're seen as Jewish gangsters worldwide, and such luminaries, even as Churchill, who was then a journalist, wrote about them as such, and how malevolent and crazy their ideas were, and how unworkable and how dangerous they were. And he said that Jews are the driving power behind communism. But they were not recognized by the U.S. until FDR, another decade plus from when this was written. So their ambassador, quote-unquote, left. He was kicked out. In his place, he deputed Charles Recht, and through him, all these labor unions or these radical, dangerous Bolshevik unions pass through that hub for their messages. So Ford says the situation in New York is important because from that center, lines of authority and action radiate to all the cities of the U.S. New York is the laboratory in which the emissaries of the revolution learn their lesson, and their knowledge is being daily increased by the counsel and experience of traveling delegates straight out of Russia. I encourage you and others to read E. Michael Jones on what was going on with Americans who went over to Russia after the revolution. It's culturewars.com. The American does not realize that all the public disturbances of which he reads are not mere sudden outbreaks. There's nothing spontaneous about them. But the deliberately planned movements of leaders who know exactly what they are doing. Mobs are methodical. There is always an intelligent core which gets done under the appearance of excitement what had been planned beforehand. So on the surface level, there's all this spontaneous uprising, but underneath it's all planned. Up through the German Revolution, up through the French Revolution, up through the Russian Revolution came the previously chosen men, and to this day in all three countries, the groups thus raised to power have not lessened their hold, and they are Jewish groups. Russia is not more Jew-controlled than is France, and Germany, with all her so-called anti-Semitism, tries in vain to loosen the grip of Judah from her throat. I mean, think about it. We just heard in the last chapter how Jews dominate the music industry. If they are willing and able to dominate music, do you really think they would leave something like politics to chance? No, because that's the master. Once you control the politics, you control pretty much everything else, or at least whatever you want to, or at least you're in a position to prevent any kind of opposition. It is the fact of prepared disorder which makes the New York situation of interest today, because its lines of influence and authority reach everywhere throughout the country. For that reason, and before showing how the Jewish organizations advance Bolshevism and revolution in the United States, the first step will be to describe the condition and extent of the Hebrew labor movement. Most New Yorkers remember the Save Fifth Avenue movement. That avenue, that's where all the retailers are on Fifth Avenue in New York. Big showfront windows. That avenue from 14th to 34th Street, so 20 blocks, with sections of Broadway, is historic ground. It is wrought into the history of America in a peculiarly intimate way. A little more than 15 years ago, it contained the homes of the older families, the establishments of famous publishers, the stores of art dealers, and the famous shopping center. It was a district known throughout the United States as typifying American substance and good taste. But presently, Americans who thought that they were secure in their own city were aware of an advancing shadow. A subtle atmosphere of deterioration became evident. In the top lofts of buildings, sweatshops had been installed, which noon and night poured into the streets an alien stream. Not a glad, hopeful-eyed immigrant rejoicing to be in America and at work, but something darker. It was the Russian and Polish Jew. He swarmed into this district, the most typically American of any outside of Boston and Philadelphia, from the first. Nowhere else would the sweatshops go except in the very heart of goy respectability. There were protests and organizations. Jews were appealed to in the name of the city. They smiled and promised, but like a tide coming in, the invasion swept farther and stronger every week. New Yorkers hesitated to go down into the district to trade, and merchants lost their business. Real estate values dropped in consequence, and the Jews bought valuable properties at low figures. Today, at noontime, Fifth Avenue is packed from wall to curb with dark, squat figures in masses of thousands. They parade in dense throngs and make the street impassable. They make a strange, un-American atmosphere, Slavonic with some Oriental admixture. This was described by H.P. Lovecraft, I think it was, describing the racial bizarreness of New York and the un-Americanness of it around this time, or actually 20 years before. Their tongue is alien. Their attitude is one of sullenness mingled with a sense of power. You leave the New York of American meaning whenever you approach that alien throng. They have taken over the district as completely as if they had invaded it with a bayonet. All this would be very hopeful, of course, if we could take and sustain the attitude of the unsophisticated young reader of fiction and regard these people as, quote, new Americans, unquote. There is a mass of moving stories, mostly written by Jews, by the way, pretending to describe the glowing hearts with which these throngs look out upon America, their intense longing to be American, their love of our people and our institutions. Most unfortunately, the actions of these people and the utterances of their leaders give the lie to this fair picture, which, as Americans, we would fain believe, fain meaning gladly. The resistance offered to Americanization, consisting in the limitations put upon the Americanization program, has been sufficient to convince all observers that, so far as the Jewish invasion is concerned, it is not their desire to go the way America is going, but to influence America to go the way they are going. They talk a great deal of what they bring to America, hardly anything at all of what they found here. America is presented to them as a big piece of putty to be molded as they desire, not as a benign mother who is able and willing to make these aliens to be like her own children. The doctrine that the United States is nothing definite as yet, that it is only a free-for-all opportunity to make it what you will, is one of the most distinctive of Jewish teachings. If it be provincialism to insist that our alien guests become American and cease their endeavors to make America something alien, then there are hundreds of thousands of Americans to plead guilty to provincialism. The melting pot, a term to which Mr. Zangwill gave currency, is not a very dignified name for our republic, but aside from that, it is being more and more challenged as descriptive of the process that goes on here. There are some substances in the pot that will not melt, but more significant still, there are rapidly increasing interests who want the pot to melt. So far as Fifth Avenue is concerned, it was the pot that melted. At least, not the most intrepid Jewish leader will shout much about the American characteristics of the most conspicuous Jewish colony in the world, that of New York. The lofty buildings in this district are filled with clothing workshops, of which the Jew has a monopoly in the U.S. Coat makers, pant makers, buttonhole workers, ladies' garment workers. These men are engaged in the quote-unquote needle trades, in which adult men of no other race participate. Why the tendency of the Jew to the needle trades? It is explained by his aversion to manual labor, his abhorrence of agricultural life, and his desire to arrange his own affairs. Arriving in the city of his destination, the Jew would rather not leave it except for other cities. There is one Hebrew society whose charter would indicate that its work is the placing of Jews in the rural districts, but it does next to nothing in this respect. On the other hand, there is testimony that city colonization goes on apace. Widespread Jewish associations are on the lookout for likely towns in which to settle a few Jews, who in time become a larger colony, and in a little longer time run the place. There is nothing haphazard about it. The Jew is not an adventurer. He does not cut himself off from his base, but all his movements are made under consultation and direction. New York is the great training school in which the newly arrived immigrant receives his instructions as to the method of handling the American goyim. Thus, preferring any kind of a life in the city and not taking to the trades which involve much bodily effort, the Jew gravitates to the needle, not in the capacity of a creative artist, as is the commercial tailor, but in the production of quantities of ready-to-wear goods. And remember, we're talking about the early 1900s, and we're coming off probably all traditional society up until the last 100 years before that that had made its own clothes, before you had the Industrial Revolution and the cotton mills and the, you know, you've seen the pictures of the women working the spindles and such. Before then, it was all done at home with homespun. People spun their own cloth and made their own clothes. And the Jews would just be like itinerant wandering Jews who were tailors or selling old rags, used rags or kitchen appliance type stuff. Aside from the white-collar quality of the job, the needle trades appeal to the Jew because at such work he can practically arrange his own hours. For this reason, the Jew generally prefers piecework to day work, domestic industries to factories. He can arrange his own time. Many people wonder how the Jews of New York have so much time for revolutionary consultation, parades, meetings, demonstrations, restaurant debates, and radical authorship. Well, no other class of working people can get the time. Other people work pretty steadily. The explanation is at hand. Extreme socialism and Bolshevism have a great deal of, quote, time off, unquote. Trotsky, the present head of Russia, lived that way in New York. His main arrangement was for leisure to work up his scheme. All the East Side leaders knew that Trotsky was to, quote, take the Tsar's job, unquote, Russian Tsar, even though he never had an extra dollar to spend. There was nothing haphazard about it. It was prearranged, and the newly appointed men went directly to their pre-appointed places. The East Side has other rulers ready now, and they live in the midst of the revolutionary, quote, needle trades, unquote. One point that should not be overlooked in all this, of course, is that the needle trades, being exclusively Jewish, all their abuses are Jewish too. This is said for the benefit of those apologists for Russian Bolshevism who explain that the reason for it all is the way the poor, quote, Russian, unquote, was treated in America. If Americans will ever learn to remember that the Russian is not a Jew, and that Bolshevism is not Russian, but Jewish, and if in addition to that, the American will ever learn to remember that every Russian Jewish laborer in New York comes into contact with a Russian Jewish employer, and every Russian Jew tenant pays his exorbitant rent to a Russian Jew landlord, it will then be clear that once more has the United States been made to bear a slander that does not belong to it. It wasn't us that forced the revolution, it was Jews, in other words. It may be well to remember that it was on account of these Russian and Polish Jews, while they yet resided in Russia, that the United States broke off her trade treaty with that country, broke off with Russia, that was a country and a government before America was discovered, and having by that act contributed to the Jewish throttle on Russia through Germany, which we heard about in an earlier installment. It is now proposed that the United States, on account of these same Jews, enter into trade agreements with the present Russian tyranny. Verily, the diplomacy of Judah has come very near determining our foreign policy. If they were strong enough, in spite of President Taft's refusal to make us break with Russia when Russia had never done anything wrong, they may also be strong enough to make us shake hands with Bolshevism. And so it proved in another dozen years or so. I think it was 32 or 33 when that happened, when we formally recognized the Jewish gangsters. The Jewish trade union is exclusively Jewish for the reason that the trades affected are exclusively Jewish. That is, the Jewish trade union is not an American trade union. It is not a mixed trade union. It is Jewish. Like all other Jewish activities, the purpose of the trade union is to advance Jewish interests alone. These unions are one aspect of United Israel, capital U and I. This should be borne in mind with reference to the widespread strikes in the clothing trade and the rapid increase in the price of clothing to the 99 million non-Jews in the United States. In spite of all the strikes, the profits advanced enormously. It may be said that the strikes were essential to the advance of profits, and the country as a whole paid. Look at some of the figures of the needle trades before the war. In the entire U.S., the men's and women's clothing manufactured in 1914 had a value of $932,099,000. So somewhat under a billion, but over $930 million. In New York alone, $542,685,000 worth was produced. The rest was produced by Jewish clothing centers in Chicago, Cleveland, New Jersey, and Philadelphia. So about a manufactured clothing is about a $1 billion industry in 1914, the year of the war, and then about more than half of that comes from out of New York, and the rest comes from another four or five cities. The figures for the period of war and since will be staggering. Clothing in the regular trade began to mount in price until at the end of the war in 1918, it had attained an increase of 200% and 300%. And remember, this is during a period in which you don't have a Federal Reserve while it had just started, where it's not inflating the money supply so that inflation, the rise in prices means more. So they're saying that prices of clothing went up 2 to 3 times during the war, 200 to 300%. Until well into 1920, the monopoly held up the price. This was done in the face of the declaration by the manufacturers of cloth that the whole profiteering persistence was due to the manufacturers of clothing. So again, you have the raw material in the field. That's one level in the supply chain. Then you have the people who make the cloth. That's the next level. Then you have the people who manufacture the actual goods. That's another level. And then you have the wholesalers. And finally, the retailers. You see, so it goes through all these different stations along the supply chain is what it's called. So it wasn't the price of cloth that went up. It was coming from the manufacturers of clothing. Russian Polish Jews in this country, only a few months, drew $50 to $80 a week. Threats of strike were used to get a 5% increase in wages, which was met by a 20% increase in the cost of clothing. The American public paid. If, however, these statements were merely an attempt to arouse indignation that, for once the workers got more than they earned, the attempt would be a failure. It is pretty hard to find anyone to regret the workers getting hold of a bonanza. The high wages weren't of much use, as it proved, but people at least had the satisfaction of handling them. These statements are made to show that during the war, the Jewish unions waxed fat, a fact which has a bearing on their Bolshevik attitude today. Not all the wage was the gain of the man who earned it. There was the union to pay. Girls in the fur trade in New York earned $55 a week, of which they paid in $27.50 a week to the unions. Other workers paid in like proportion. Isn't that amazing? They paid about half their salary to the unions, or exactly half their salary. There was a great talk of what would be done. In Russia, of course, they had the government's gold vaults immediately upon the success of the revolution, but in the U.S., the preliminary funds would have to be supplied by themselves. A great revolutionary stroke was planned, of which the written evidence still remains. There are two divisions of Jewish wealth and power centering in New York. The first is German Jewish, represented by the Schiffs, the Spires, the Warburgs, the Kahns, the Lewissons, and the Guggenheims. These play the game with the aid of the financial resources of the non-Jews. The other division is composed of the Russian and Polish Jews who monopolize the hat, cap, fur, garment, and toy trades. By the way, it is the Russian and Polish Jew who controls the American stage and movies also. So you have the older, more established German Jews, and then you have the newcomer, the radical communist Eastern Polish and Russian Jews. Between them, they control a lot of different industries, you see. Between them, their grip and influence is far from negligible. They may sometimes have an internecine quarrels. You see the older, established German Jews who were somewhat more assimilated, not to WASPness, but more to their manners, regarded the newcoming Eastern European Jews as very coarse and crude. And they didn't like how they behaved. They wanted them to get better. So these are the generation they're naming all their kids, like Lewis and Llewellyn and Murray. And stuff like Murray Rothbard would be an example of a Jew of that generation when they're trying to ape the Anglo gentry, at least outwardly, since they don't have the soul of it, in order to seem more polished. And yeah, there was a if not a war, there was a sharp cultural divide between those Jews. But ultimately, as we've seen so many times, they're all on the same page. They're going to mulct the Gentile for his money and take over his politics, create their own system and machine, and America is putty in their hands, as Ford has so much has said. Between them, their grip and influence is far from negligible. They may sometimes have internecine quarrels regarding the division of profits, and eager publicists may zealously call attention to these quarrels as evidence of the lack of unity among the Jews. But in the Kehillah, that's the Jewish government in diaspora, in exile, of which New York, as we've heard in earlier sessions, New York Kehillah is the most powerful one in the world, and elsewhere, they understand each other pretty well. And on the question of Jew versus quote-unquote Goy, they are indivisibly one. They're all part of Team Jew against non-existent Team Goy or Team White, as I style it. Between these two forces, the attempt to hold up prices was continued until late in 1920. The heads of the Jewish clothing associations announced that the price of clothing would not be lowered. Solidly behind them were the Associated Hebrew Labor Unions, so-called, which threatened dire things if the prices came down. The first great store to reduce prices in New York was Wanamaker's, a non-Jewish house. In fact, there was no reduction of prices among Jewish manufacturers and merchants generally until in the month of November. Less than a dozen Jews were called into the presence of a non-Jewish financier, after which a belated effort was made to save the buying market by sensational reductions. The Jewish controllers of the clothing business had just previously stated that not only would prices not go down, but the 1921 prices would go higher still. There is a distinction between what the Jewish coalition would do and what it could do, but its will and its power never so closely correspond as when the non-Jewish element is asleep, and never are Jewish will and power so widely divorced as when the non-Jewish mind is alert. When the non-Jewish financial mind made itself felt in November 1920, the bottom dropped out of the Jewish trade prophecies and policies. The only thing to fear is not the alert Jew, but the consequences of sleepiness among the Christians. The Jewish program is checked the moment it is perceived and identified. That might have been true in some areas then, but it's hardly true in any areas now. Ordinary people who for 5 years have been paying high tribute to the clothing trust are entitled to know who compromised that trust. But that is a trifling affair compared with the political uses to which the clothing trust has been put in this country. The clothing trust, being composed exclusively of Jews, most of whom have formed the axe head of Jewry in the fight against certain old world governments, is today the heart and center of a movement that, if successful, would leave not a shred of the Republic, its institutions, nor even the liberty, which is every American's by inheritance. What is the strength of these people? How are they banded together? What are the facts concerning them? In New York City alone, there are 2,760 Jewish cloak and suit manufacturing concerns, 1,200 Jewish clothing manufacturers, 2,880 Jewish fur manufacturers, 600 Jewish skirt manufacturers, 600 manufacturing tailoring establishments, 800 Jewish merchant tailoring concerns. These employers have organized themselves into associations such as the following. Long list here of the different associations Jews have formed in their clothing trust. Associated Boys Clothing Manufacturers of Greater New York. Associated Fur Manufacturers. Associated Shirt Manufacturers. Association of Embroidery and Lace Manufacturers. Children's Dress Manufacturers Association. Cloak, Suit, and Skirt Manufacturers Protective Association, Cotton Garment Manufacturers of New York, Dress and Waist Manufacturers Association, East Side Retail Clothing Manufacturers Association, Ladies Hat Manufacturers Protective Association, Mineral Water Dealers Protective Association, National Association of Separate Skirt Manufacturers, National Society of Men's Neckwear Manufacturers, New York Association of House Dress and Kimono Manufacturers. New York Tailors Verein. Verein is a German word for association. Probably also in Yiddish, I would guess. Shirt Manufacturers Protective Association. So these are a bunch of their associations. Among the employed Jews, the unions are numerous, but all gathered up into one central organization. For example, the International Fur Workers Union of the United States and Canada is made up of the following. Feather Boa Makers Union, Fur Cap Makers Union, Fur Cutters Union, Fur Dressers Union, Fur Dyers Union, Fur Floor Walkers Union, Fur Hatters Union, Fur Head and Tail Makers Union, Fur Line Coat Finishers Union, Fur Nailers Union, Fur Operators Union, Fur Pluckers Union, Muff Bed Workers Union. In the garment industry, the organizations include every operation in the process of making clothes. There are separate unions for buttonhole makers, vest makers, pants makers, coat cutters, coat operators, coat pressers, coat tailors, coat basters, lapel makers, knee pants makers, clothing turners, overall workers, Palm Beach workers, shirt makers, vest pressers, and even a washable sailor suit union. These together comprise the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. In children's clothing, we have another complete organization. Children's Jacket Makers, three unions. Children's Jacket Pressers. Children's Sailor Jacket Makers Union. Children's Cloak and Reefer Workers Union. Children's Dressmakers Union. In women's wear, there are unions organized around every garment known to the wardrobe. Some of which are Amalgamated Ladies Garment Cutters Union, Bonaz Singer and Hand Embroiderers Union, Buttonhole Makers and Button Sewers Union, Children's Cloak and Reefer Workers Union, Cloak and Suit Piece Tailors and Sample Makers Union, Cloak Examiner Squares and Bushlers Union, Cloak Makers Union, Cloak Operators Union, Cloak Skirt and Dress Pressers Union, Ladies and Mrs. Cloak Operators Union, Ladies Tailors and Alteration and Special Order Union, Ladies Waist and Dressmakers Union, Skirt and Cloth Dressmakers Union, Waterproof Garment Workers Union, White Goods Workers Union, Wrapper, Kimono, House Dress and Bathrobe Makers Union. These unions comprise the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. The reader will have an idea after reading these lists that the employees represented in these unions are women. The majority are men. It may require something of an effort to remember that, but it is essential. So just because they're making clothes for women, actually the ones doing it are men. These organizations control an essential business which, before the war, produced over $1 billion worth of goods a year, and since the war has probably received for its products each year the amount of a big fat Liberty loan, and these unions have received 30-40% of that for wages and propaganda funds. Now let it be said at once that these Jewish unions are not to be confused with the regular labor union movement as we know it in the United States, which would be obviously not political but simply concerned about its own wages and conditions, which is the reason a union might exist. They are not Jews who have gone into the American trades unions. They have started unions of their own, which are Jewish in membership, control, and purpose. It is true, of course, that the regular trades union movement, which heads up in the American Federation of Labor, is under the presidency of a Jew, Samuel Gompers, but the membership is mixed, the large majority being non-Jews, and the purpose is not racial. The Jewish unions comprise a body by themselves and are to be reckoned with not only as labor union groups, but as racial and political groups whose purposes can be determined by the character and utterances of their leaders, as well as by the actions authorized and approved by the unions themselves. Now, this Hebrew union movement is a part of the New York Kehillah. Jewish leaders have sought to counteract the Dearborn Independence account of Kehillah activities by saying that the Kehillah is such a weak little thing. Admittedly, however, the Jewish Clothing Trust and the Jewish Garment Workers Unions are among the biggest and most powerful aggregations in the country. Not even a Jewish leader would have the temerity to deny that. Well, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America and the International Ladies Garment Workers Union are affiliated with the Kehillah. More than that, this Kehillah, K-E-H-I-L-L-A-H, if you didn't hear our earlier broadcast on the chapter devoted to explaining how the Kehillah operates, more than that, this Kehillah, which Jewish spokesmen with cool contempt for truth would have the public believe was weak and unimportant, this same Kehillah in its executive committee constitutes the American Jewish Committee. So, Jews are completely racially organized. And you can't be fooled by names or exteriors, which may be neutral or seemingly have nothing to do with Jews or politics at all and are purely related to trade. In fact, all that doesn't really matter. It's window dressing to fool the public. In fact, they're racially organized, pursuing a racial agenda that is pretty easily identifiable and always anti-white. Is the American Jewish Committee, the AJC, a non-entity? Ask any president of the U.S., any senator, or any governor. The American Jewish Committee heads up in District Number 12, New York City, and the committee for District Number 12 is also the executive committee of the Kehillah. See how that works. We heard about that again earlier in the earlier chapter. The men who represent before the world the combined organizations mentioned in this article are the Kehillah, and they are the American Jewish Committee. And besides, they are the men whose failure and candor has left such an impression of dissatisfaction throughout the masses of the Jewish people. The men who represent before the world the combined organizations mentioned in this article are the Kehillah, and they are the American Jewish Committee. And besides, they are the men whose failure and candor has left such an impression of dissatisfaction throughout the masses of the Jewish people. Who are they? Who are these men with whom the Kehillah is said to be such a puling thing? Louis Marshall of the law firm Guggenheim, Untermeyer & Marshall. Mr. Marshall is not only the head of District 12, but he is also the head of the American Jewish Committee. His headship of the AJC makes him the Jewish leader of the United States. His headship of District Number 12 makes him the head of the New York Kehillah. Quite an important man, yes, and an important place, in spite of lying Jewish spokesmen. Who are the others? Eugene Meyer, Jr., formerly of the Capital Issues Committee of the United States government. And I think he went on to have something to do with the Washington Post, or at least it was the same name. Who else? Judah L. Magnus, M-A-G-N-E-S. Judah L. Magnus is the organizer and active leader of the New York Kehillah. The two bodies are linked up again. They are linked up by the Kehillah's constitution, which is able to decree that its executive committee shall be the American Jewish Committee as far as District Number 12, New York City, is concerned. There are other names in the American Jewish Committee, which also constitutes the executive committee as the Kehillah. Adolf Lewison, Cyrus L. Sulzberger, again, New York Times name, Felix Warburg, Federal Reserve name, and so on, 36 in all. And remember what he said in a different chapter. It's the same recurring names that head all these top Jewish committees and organizations and that apply pressure to any goyim doing something or in a position to influence something they want influenced. In the current annual report of the American Jewish Committee, this relation with the Kehillah is acknowledged in a note at the foot of page 123. Just as in the constitution of the Kehillah, its relation with the AJC is acknowledged and explained. Now, to recapitulate, the Hebrew labor unions, both of employees and employers, which are in the control of the garment industry, which are in control of the garment industry of the United States, represent one wing of Jewish aggression in the realm of political revolutionism. It is not a small wing in itself. Certainly it does not become smaller by its connection with the Kehillah, nor the Kehillah by its gain of these workers. The two unions mentioned above number over 337,000 members. That figure is conservative. So you've got, you know, the better part of 500,000 of these Jews in these trades who are very actively working with and integrated with the top Jewish bodies, the AJC and the committee leading District 12, the New York Kehillah. Besides these, there are associated with the Kehillah the members of 1,000 other Jewish organizations, such as synagogues, charitable societies, and educational bodies, and 100,000 individual members who belong on their own account. Link this organization with the powerful American Jewish Committee, and at once the protest of the editors and the spokesmen that the Kehillah is a weak, unimportant body becomes a deliberate falsehood. And as for those, quote, Gentile fronts, unquote, who are ready victims of Jewish propaganda, and who, without personal knowledge, are describing the Kehillah as a large and flourishing charitable society, bad teamwork there. Let them read in the next article what some of the Kehillah leaders are trying to do to the United States. And we're going to hit that next article in this same session. But anyway, this was the end of chapter 49. 16 April 1921, and now we move immediately on to the next chapter. Jew trades link with world revolutionaries. The Jew trades, the needle workers, and their link with the world revolution, continuing our story. Henry Ford says, "There are more Bolsheviks in the United States than there are in Soviet Russia. Their aim is the same, and their racial character is the same. If they're not able to do here what they have done there, it is because of the greater dissemination of information, the higher degree of intelligence, and the wider diffusion of the agencies of governmental authority than obtains in unhappy Russia. The powerhouse of Bolshevik influence and propaganda in the U.S. is in the Jewish trade unions, which, almost without exception, adhere to a Bolshevik program for their respective industries and for the country as a whole. This fact is proving most embarrassing to the Jewish leaders at the present moment. It is bad enough that Russian Bolshevism should be so predominantly Jewish, but to confront the same situation in the United States is a double burden of which Jewish leaders do not know how to dispose. Yet it is difficult to see how the international Jew can be absolved either from the necessity of being confronted with it, his responsibility for this revolutionary horror and misery, or from the necessity of bearing sole responsibility for it. Russian Bolshevism came out of the east side of New York, where it was fostered by the encouragement, the religious, moral, and financial encouragement of Jewish leaders. Leon Trotsky, Brownstein, was an east sider. Whether he was a member of the New York Kehillah is not known. But the forces which fostered what he stood for, centered in the Kehillah, and both the Kehillah and its associated American Jewish Committee were interested in the work he set out to do, namely the overthrow of an established government, one of the allies of the United States in the recent war. Russian Bolshevism was helped to its objective by Jewish gold from the United States, and now that it is found to be numerically much stronger in the United States than it is in Russia, the fact causes no little embarrassment. Denial is useless, for the thing is too blatant and has advertised itself too long. What amazes the student of the Jewish question in the United States is the stupidity which permitted Jewish Bolshevism to flaunt itself so openly during the past few years. The only explanation that seems at all adequate is that the Jews never dreamed that the American people would become sufficiently awake to challenge them. The present widespread exposure of Jewish tactics in the United States has doubtless come as a surprise to the Jewish leaders, and this cannot be accounted for otherwise than that they thought they had gained too strong a grip on the American mind to make a challenge possible. I mean, it's goddamn incredible. They come to this country, and within 10 years, they're controlling everything. That says there's something fundamentally not functioning correctly with whites. That's what that tells me. They were unable to identify and stop a threat. I mean, leave alone stop the threat. We're unable to identify the threat. Horrifying. Says Ford, It remains to be seen whether the Jewish leaders shall be able to control the Frankenstein that their false policies have created. Following exactly the program which the Jewish leaders approved for Russia, the organized Jews of New York are exhibiting a zeal and a directness which Jewish leaders would like to curb for the present, if we are to judge from some of the complaints that the Bolshevik Jews are making. Benjamin Schlesinger, like Laura Schlesinger, president of the International Garment Workers Union, whose membership numbers 150,000 and which is part of the New York Kahila, is one of the complainants. His union, of course, is not the regular American labor union formed for the betterment of working conditions and wages. It is a revolutionary union for the complete change of the social system, involving also a change of government. In an interview printed in the Jewish Forward of April 8, Schlesinger complains against the manner in which Jewish judges have recently come to interfere with Jewish strikes. He says, okay, so Schlesinger in the Jewish Forward says, three paragraph block quote, "And Jewish judges come to their assistance. They issue injunctions, and it is said that they do it to save the Jewish name so that it shall not be said that, quote, all Jews are Bolshevists. So the injunctions become a Jewish affair. We have a gigantic, wide-branched kahila in New York, in all corners, Jews. All over, what you see and what you hear, Jews, and of course dress, politicians, and greater ones. But only we may say this, and I understand Schlesinger." Schlesinger explains it this way. I thought Schlesinger was the one giving the quote, so something was a little mixed up there, but Schlesinger explains it this way. "Several reasons are given why judges, like, here a Jewish judge is named, twist the law. The real purpose is to break our strike. But then, after all, there is a reason, a Jewish reason. He wants to demonstrate to the American community, he claims, that not all Jews are Bolshevists." Says Ford, "This excerpt shows several things, that only, quote, we, unquote, may say certain things, that Jewish authority is trying to cover the blemish of Bolshevism, and that this is done in order to demonstrate to, quote, the American community, unquote, a certain desirable thing. The Jewish community, it is presumed, is not so easily impressed. The Kahila is apparently trying to call in its kites, but they have apparently flown too high in the rarefied atmosphere of revolutionism." Trying to temper their speed with which they're trying to revolutionize the country a little bit. Another big union which makes part of the New York Kahila is the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America, whose membership is about 200,000. It is officered by Russian Jews, whose pronounced Bolshevik utterances have been widely reported in the Jewish press of New York, until plain and unprivileged Americans have wondered how far treason to the U.S. government could go on our own soil. Sidney Hillman, the president, is one of the most radical socialists in the United States, so radical that he would probably spurn the name of the socialist as ordinarily used. He is a Sovietist. He is so far, quote, advanced, unquote, that to him the regular type of American labor union is a, quote, a scab union, unquote. The purpose of the American labor union is stated to be the improvement of the workers' condition in industry and the establishment of their industrial rights, whereas the object of Hillman's union is the overthrow of industry and its communization in the hands of the radical element, that is to say, Russia all over again. Hillman was born in Russia. He personally knows most of the Bolshevik Jews now ruining that great land. So that's Sidney Hillman. The secretary of the Amalgamated is Joseph Schlossberg. Schloss means castle in German. Also born in Russia. Schlossberg, Berg means mountain in Russia, so castle mountain. Schlossberg has a very free gift of words. One of his promises to his Jewish followers, publicly made at Madison Square Garden, is this, quote, "The clothing industry is ours. We are not going to permit the employer to determine where his factory shall be or how many hours we shall work." Abraham Shiplakov, S-H-I-P-L-A-C-O-F-F, a socialist member of the New York Board of Aldermen, and next to Sidney Hillman in command of the Amalgamated, is also a free speaker, as the following excerpt will show. Quote, We are going to move heaven and earth to educate our people that they and they alone are the owners of this industry. The workers of Russia have found it out. God bless them. If I knew old Sammy Gompers knew as much as that, I would tell you to go and do what the workers did in Turin. 10,000 of them marched to the factory with music and a flag and opened the doors and went to work and said, to hell with the owners of the factory. Everybody knows it is war. We are going to control the industry. And I believe Samuel Gompers, although a Jew, was very anti-communist. Always the omission, of course, that the factories so spectacularly captured ceased to run soon after. The Hillmans and Schlossbergs and the Shiplakovs are heroic figures on the platform, but in manufacturing the common commodities of life and making both ends meet so that the consumer may be served and the producer rewarded, they have been the most tragic failures. Quote, the workers of Russia have found it out. God help them. As a matter of fact, besides the IWW, or the Wobblies, the Socialists, the Amalgamated is the only organization which not only preaches Bolshevism, but actually practices it, all in the United States and all apparently in perfect consistency with its membership in the Kahila and under the officership of the High Gentleman of the American Jewish Committee. The Amalgamated actually does run the industry, which has mulcted such a heavy tax from the American public since 1914. They tell the factory manager where the factory is to be located. These are a bunch of semi-bullets in the style of bullet points about how the union has mulcted the American public. They tell the factory manager where the factory is to be located. They have a minimum wage of $12 a day, independent of skill or production. They enforce the rule that an employee who has worked for 2 weeks has thereafter a job for life. No improved machinery can be introduced without the union's permission. The employer cannot even hire a cartage firm that the union has not first approved. The employer cannot withdraw from business unless he goes into bankruptcy, else the whole force of the union shall be marshaled against him and his. He must inform the union of all his plans in advance. This, of course, is part of the endowment of Trotsky to the East Side. He did great missionary work there while waiting to go across and take the Tsar's place. Even to this day, in the Jew-controlled theaters that crowd Broadway, the picture of Trotsky brings wild, delirious cheering, while the portrait of the President of the United States is hissed. A favorite state scene is the Star of David high over all flags. The recent debate between Senators King and France, said to have been organized with the assistance of two rabbis, developed into such an outrageously anti-American, pro-Soviet demonstration that prudence intervened to prevent a vote. Recently, when pro-Jewish Germans endeavored to stir up trouble by holding a great mass meeting to protest the alleged, quote, black horror on the Rhine, unquote, the audience was packed with Jews. Not that they love Germany more, but they love any regular government less. While a few days later, at a great American meeting, the Jews of New York, according to the testimony of incredulous observers, were most conspicuous by their absence. Now, the Jewish leaders must admit that the Jewish question does not consist in American citizens uncovering these facts and helping other American citizens to become aware of them. The Jewish question inheres in the facts themselves and in Jewish responsibility for the facts. If it is anti-Semitism to say that Bolshevism in the U.S. is Jewish, so be it. But to unprejudiced minds, it will look very like Americanism. There is not a single solitary American-born citizen serving as an officer or director of those great unions which form part of the New York Kahila. These men have not the faintest idea of what America stands for. They are not here to become Americanized, but to change America to their own model. In this, they have articulated support of most of the Jewish They have the articulated support of most of the Jewish rabbis who have been very keen to explain that Americanization does not at all mean what the American means by it. Always the Jew is going to interpret. He's going to determine who you are. He's going to explain you, my God, even to yourself. This is what we resist. America will have become what these people want it to be when America is Sovietized with Jewish radicals in control and that is the objective toward which they are working now. The other officers of the Amalgamated are Jacob Potowski, secretary, who is a Russian Jew, and J.B. Salutsky, who is also a Russian Jew and, quote, national director of the educational department, unquote, which means that he is the propagandist of the Union in the United States. Regarding the assertion that the great radical unions are not officered by native-born citizens, the statement has been made that Russian Jews do not usually complete their citizenship, but stop short at the declaration of intention, end quotes. There is some interesting material in a study of 2,000 presidents of Jewish organizations in New York City. So, there's over 2,000 Jewish organizations in New York City, and a study of 2,000 presidents of them. Of this number, more than half, 1,054, were born in Russia, 536 in Austro-Hungary, 90 in Romania, 64 in Germany, and 4 in Palestine. These countries produced 89.1% of Jewish leaders in New York. So basically a bunch of Russian Jews, and then secondarily Austro-Hungarian is about a quarter. Of this number, 531 entered the country between the ages of 14 and 21, and 977 entered over the age of 21. Of this number, 1,270 are still under 50 years of age. These figures include all organizations from synagogues to trade unions. How far they have been Americanized or wish to be can only be judged by the policies and activities of the organizations which they direct. The big Jewish labor organizations are the direct offspring of the Jewish Socialist Bund of Russia. Big Jew labor organizations are the direct offspring of the Jewish Socialist Bund of Russia. It is due to the propaganda of the Bund in the United States that the United Hebrew Trades have gone over to the ranks of radicalism. Bundists, the Bund is like a union, and it's a German word. Bundists swarmed to the U.S. after the abortive revolution of 1905, the failed one in Russia, that was sort of a portent for the successful one in 1917. Bundists swarmed to the U.S. after the abortive revolution of 1905, at which time they failed to put Bolshevism over in Russia, and these Bundists gave their time to the Bolshevizing of the Hebrew trade unions in this country. An agitation bureau was formed, which propagated radical socialism through the medium of the Yiddish language, which is one of the official languages of the New York Kehilla. Again, Kehilla is the Jewish government in exile in any particular country or community. Made so by the demands of the Kehilla's overwhelming radical constituency. The Bundists incorporated in 1905 in New York an organization known as, quote, the Workmen's Circle, and, quote, swelled the ranks of the Jewish trade unions, unquote, to quote the Kehilla's Register, capital R. After a brief attempt to propagate socialism without reference to the Jewish question, it was given up, and in 1913 a resolution was adopted declaring that the whole purpose of the work was Jewish. This is attributed in the Kehilla record to the spread of, quote, the idea of Jewish nationalism. Now, care would have to be exercised to avoid confusion between the Hebrew labor unions, radical as they are, and the avowed communistic bodies, if it were not the fact that the unions and communists are so inextricably interlocked as to make distinctions unnecessary. That this is not a judgment dictated by mere adverse attitude may be seen from the following facts. The Workmen's Circle has 800 branches throughout the U.S. and is officered by Jews throughout. The membership is 98% foreign-born and is Jewish in like proportion, so only about maybe 2% aren't Jews out of the Workmen's Circle. Among the higher officers of this organization are Joseph Schlesinger, Sidney Hillman, Benjamin Schlossberg, Sam Feinstein, and J.B. Salutsky, L.U.T. The names will probably have become familiar to the reader by this time. They form part of the interlocking directorate so commonly found among Jewish organizations, a system that finally heads up in the Executive Committee of the Kehilla, which also composes the leaders of the American Jewish Committee, of which the great public lights of Jewry are members, the marshals. the Weises, the Guggenheims, and such. And Schlesinger is president of the Union of Ladies Garment Workers and made a trip to Russia in behalf of communism in the United States to finance which the members of the Communist Party were assessed $150 each. Hillman is president of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. Schlossberg is secretary of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. Feinstein is secretary of the United Hebrew Trades. Salutsky is food commissar to the striking Amalgamated and is national director of Bolshevik propaganda carried on by his crowd. They are, of course, all Jews. The lineup is this. Hebrew trade union leaders are also members of the Workmen's Circle and of the Communist Party, and the majority of their trade union followers go with them into the other associations. The reverse process is this. Communism and radical Bolshevism then find their way to the consciousness of the American public by the Bolshevik demands of the so-called trade unions of Jewry. An extreme defense of all this activity might be that these Jewish leaders and workers are only enamored of the idea of Bolshevism, are playing with it academically, and are not to be considered as actively the proponents of a form of government contrary to the Constitution of the United States and to be established by, quote, direct action, unquote. This defense, however, appears insufficient when confronted by another set of facts in which these same union leaders and communists are shown to be in communication with the Soviet government in the United States, and the Soviet government in the United States is not a mere idea, it is a program. Moscow has repeatedly stated that the purpose of the Lenin-Trotsky government has been world revolution. And one reason for the colossal economic failure of the Soviet governmental experiment has been the Jewish Soviet leaders' neglect of their proper work to follow this fetish of world revolution. If one-tenth the effort had been made to govern and feed Russia that has been made to sow Bolshevik ideas in other countries, Russia today might have been in a less unhappy plight. Propaganda is the sole art which the Bolsheviks have mastered. This Soviet government in the United States, therefore, must be regarded as an advance post of world revolution. It is so regarded by those who know anything about it. It is so regarded by those who ordered the deportation of LCAK Martins, the, quote, Soviet ambassador, unquote. Martins was announced to be here for the purpose of opening up trade relations with the United States. He had a vast fund of gold. Indeed, it was to explain his gold hoard that he used this story about trade relations. The government of the United States judged, however, that his purpose here was world revolution, and the government was right. Martins has departed, but the Soviet embassy remains. As stated in a former article, Martin's successor, that's last article, is Charles Recht, who is a Russian Jew about 36 years of age. In the same building with Recht is Isaac A. Hourwich, H-O-U-R-W-I-C-H, another Russian Jew and attorney, whose office is supposed to be the headquarters whence proceeds much of the Russian Bolshevik propaganda. Now, the people who go to the offices of Recht and Hourwich are the same people whose names we've been tracing all through this interlocker, with some notable additions. Into the sanctum of ambassadorial Bolshevism in the United States come, of course, Recht the representative and Hourwich the attorney for Lenin and Trotsky in this country. I mean, it's insane that these people are allowed to carry on and do this, but they were. Another caller is Judah L. Magnus, head of the New York Kahilla. He is a rabbi without a synagogue, an extreme extremist, a master of the language of agitation, and pro-Bolshevist in his influence and his associations. He is credited with being the mediator between rich Jews and radicals when the latter are in need of funds. This is the Judah L. Magnus, head of the Kahilla, who tried to tell the New York newspaper reporters what a weak and innocent foundling the New York Kahilla is. The same Judah L. Magnus, whom the American Hebrew tried to picture as a diaphanous idealist, broken-hearted because the ghetto doesn't fall in with his educational schemes. The Kahilla is not an educational institution. It is not a welfare institution in the charitable sense. It is a nerve center of Jewish power. In Rabbi Magnus's own words, quote, a clearinghouse, unquote. And if it amounted to nothing politically and nationally, the men who are now prominent in it would soon desert it. Kehillah is just what the word signifies. The whole Jewish community, the beehive. Then, of course, there are Benjamin Schlesinger, again, president of the Ladies' Garment Workers, and Sidney Hillman, president of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, and Joseph Schlossberg, another amalgamated official whose Bolshevik utterances were quoted earlier in this article, and others of the Hebrew trades crowd whose radical relationships have been shown. In addition, there are certain immigration inspectors from Ellis Island, all Jews, of course, occasionally a courier from Russia who has slipped into the country for a secret purpose, occasionally also a courier to Russia bearing messages from Rechten Auerwitz. Then IWW leaders, Jews, among them Balatin, secretary of the IWW Metal Machinery Workers Branch, and Peltner, joint secretary of the IWW branches in New York. In close touch with these Jewish radicals are a number of revolutionists of other countries representing various violent programs against the established order. It is through the offices of Charles Recht that passports issued by the State Department of the Government of the United States are being visaed. This statement refers to a regular practice known to have been followed until a few days preceding this writing, and there is no reason to believe it has since been altered. Ambassador Recht, or Acting Ambassador Recht, or whatever he may be called, is in close touch with Soviet authorities and has full notice of all their intentions regarding American affairs. A frequent subject of conferences in Recht's office is the Soviet propaganda in America. Men like Hillman and Schlossberg and Schlesinger are merely liaison officers between the Soviets and the Hebrew trades unions. The orders received from Moscow are thus transmitted to the Jews in America and are obeyed along perfectly defined lines. Of course, Rabbi Magnus, head of the New York Kehillah, could hardly be expected to remain in ignorance of what the whole Kehillah knows. And that Magnus is temperamentally a radical, any two-minute perusal of his speeches will show. He is head of what Schlesinger calls the, quote, gigantic, wide-branched Kehillah, unquote, the foremost political racial organization in this country, a close community of a single racial type, which has its own code and its own customs and its own method of gaining its ends. This is not the whole story by any means. Schlesinger and Schlossberg and Hillman and the rest are leaders, but they are not the higher-ups. The connections run straight up to the lofty heights of those who dwell in palaces and sway the finances of the nation, and to those who play large parts in the government of the United States. The Jews who finance radical publications, good conservative Jews who form the standing illustration in the argumentative question, what possible gain can they hope from Bolshevism? Jews who pull official wires to gain immunity and privilege for known traitors and revolutionists. Jonathan Pollard was just let out of jail here recently, as I speak in 2015, as an example of what he's talking about. Jews who replenish the coffers of dangerous elements, Schiff's funding Lenin, Trotsky. It is a long story, and all of it does not require telling, for the point to be gained is not that everyone should be told, but that the involved person should be aware that it is known, proved, safely put away, in hope that the occasion to use it may never come. However, it is due the public to tell at least a part of it. The Jewish community is essentially identical with these horrible Bolshevik radicals. The Jewish leaders never played so stupid as a card as when they endeavored to minimize the Kehillah and the place it fills, nor did their Gentile echoes ever fall for so miserable an imposition. And that concludes two chapters about Jews and the trade unions and communism. And we just see that the Jews are essentially cancer cells spreading around the world, very much like in those movies, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the way they cart off trucks full of pods. that will replace the real people with fakes. Political correctness pods, you might say. Anyway, that was these two articles that we just got done doing were published in April of 1921. This last on the 23rd. So, pretty scary stuff, because 100 years later, they're still doing the same thing. They've changed superficially the terms, but the intent and the agenda remain the same. Anyway, thanks for listening to me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.